five, seven.
Yeah.
Two, five, two.
Two, five, two.
Guest house.
In this building.
Guest house.
Guest house. Okay.
No, don't make it. Forget it. It's okay.
It's okay?
Yes.
You have the responsibility.
Okay. Okay, let's begin just with an ohm. We'll sit quiet for 5 seconds and then I'll begin. Continue a little bit. I gave you from the Brahma Sutras the four qualifications according to Shankaracharya that are necessary if a person wants to inquire into Brahman and get to know Brahman directly. When I say Brahman, I mean your true self. In order to know your true self, who you really are, these are the qualifications that are necessary according to Shankara. Anybody can do this inquiry. We're doing it right now. But in order to make it your own experience, these are the qualities that are necessary. The second place, if you don't want to listen to Shankaracharya, you can listen to the author of the Bhagavad Gita. Does anyone know who the Bhagavad Gita was supposedly composed by?
Vyasa.
So Vyasa is a great Advaita Vedantin, and he's the author of this text, at least ascribed to him. And he also lists the qualifications of someone who wants to get the knowledge of the self. And this is in your handouts. If you'll turn to the seventh shloka. This portion of the Bhagavad Gita, starting in 7 and ending in 11, 7 through 11, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. These five verses, according to Vyasa, the author, according to the Gita, he's putting in the word in the mouth of Krishna, teaching Arjuna. He's telling Arjuna, if you want to get this knowledge, these are the qualities that you have to get. In Sanskrit, it's very beautiful. Let me try to recite it. You'll just hear. Does anyone know Sanskrit here? So, take a second. Amani tvam madam vitvam ahimsa shantirarjavam acharyo pasanam saucham stariyam atma vinigraha indriyarteshu vairagyam anahamkara evacha janma mrityo jaravyadi dukkadosha anudarshanam asaktirana bishvangaha putradaragrahadishu Nityam cha samachitta tvam ishtanishtu papadishu mayi cha ananya yogena bhakti ravi bicharani vivekta desha sevitum arati jana samsati adi atma jnana nityatvam tatva jnana artha darshanam etat jnanam iti matam Agnanam yato anyata. That's 7 through 11. Amanitvam, humility. Adambitvam, lack of boastfulness. Let me see how he translates these words here. Humility, unostentatiousness, adambitvam. Ahimsa, not wanting to harm any living being, not wanting to cause any living being suffering, is ahimsa. Kshantir is patience. It's like tatiksha. Putting up with the pairs of opposites is kshantir. Arjavam. Arjavam means straightforwardness. Not being a hypocrite. Not putting on a face to the world and then having a private life that's different than how you want the world to see you. Being straightforward, that's called arjavam, not being a hypocrite. Arjavam. Acharya upasanam. Acharya means the acharya, Shankaracharya. Acharya means teacher, but it means more than a teacher. It means the guru. An acharya is someone who knows the scripture, Shrotriya, and it also means achar. Achar means behavior. Not only does he know the scripture, but his behavior is perfect. What does that mean? He sets the example for the student. The student watches the teacher and sees how the teacher acts in the world. How is his behavior? Is it like everybody else, or is it different? The acharya's behavior should be different. He sets the role, the model of how we have to behave. With great effort, the acharya behaves like that with no effort at all. It's his very nature. He has to make no effort to behave properly. That's the acharya. Acharya upasanam. Upasana, they say here, means what? Worship? Service. Service to the teacher. Upasanam. Upasanam means sitting close to the teacher. Wanting to be near the teacher. Because it's only the teacher that's going to be able to remove that ignorance. It's only the teacher who's going to teach by his very behavior. How that teacher lives in this world becomes a teaching to us. He teaches us the scripture, and his very life is a teaching. Upasanam. Everybody knows the word asana. Asana means to be seated. Upa means near. Seated near a teacher is a qualification for a student. You have to be near the teacher, watch the teacher, listen to the teacher, see how he behaves. If he's behaving by like everybody else, out. You're out. You're gone. You have to not just accept what he says, you have to watch how he behaves. Is he a hypocrite? Is he trying to put his hand in your pocket? Get to that money. Because 90% of them would just want your money. If they don't want your money, you know what they want? They want you to touch their feet. They like that. There's something about that. This type of teacher is no teacher at all. The guru wants nothing from you. He only loves you because he sees you as his own self. That's the only reason. He who sees himself in all beings, that's the guru. Acharya upasanam, saucham. The student of Vedanta has to be pure. And that purity, by the way, I encourage everybody here to read in the English the commentary where Shankara is explaining these qualities. It's interesting. I'm just giving you a little summary. Saucham means this, purity. And it's twofold purity. The purity of the body, of keeping it clean and healthy. That's called sauchyam, bathing. When you become a monk in the Advaita tradition, you're supposed to bathe minimum 3 times a day, whether you need it or not. The morning, afternoon, and evening. If someone touches you, and you're a sannyasi, a traditional sannyasi, you're supposed to take a bath. There's a thing about pure, because you don't know where this person was, who he is, the vibrations. So if they touch you, they observe a thing, the sannyasis, the real sannyasis, they won't even let you touch their feet. If you touch their, try to touch their feet, they jump back. It's called muddy. It seems like a silly thing to us, but it's a kind of lifestyle that they've adopted. So that's sauchyam, keeping the body clean. But that's only the gross purity. The real sauchyam is your mind, purity of mind. That mind that's not thinking about the world, but thinking about God, that unchanging reality within you. That's called sauchyam, purity of mind, purity of body. Sauchyam, stariyam, firmness, firmness in this desire to attain liberation. Stariyam, firmness in my sadhana. I'm going to do this. I'm going to achieve this. I am going to attain self-realization. I want this and I'm going to get this. And I'm going to make the greatest efforts to do that. That firmness of conviction is called stariyam. Atma vinigraha. Controlling the self. This constant control of the self, because the self wants to go everywhere. Here the self means the mind. Control of the mind. Indriyarteshu vairagyam. This next shloka. Vairagyam, they say here, aversion. I told you what vairagya is. Having no desire for any pleasure. Vairagya, for what? Indriyarteshu, in the objects of the senses. The senses want to enjoy the objects. That ice cream, when the sense of taste, when that ice cream touches the tongue, and we get that happiness from the objects outside, the person who has vairagya for those objects of the senses is called indriyarteshu vairagyam. Everyone else is looking to satisfy the senses, but he has dispassion towards those objects of the senses. Indriyarteshu vairagyam anahamkara evacha. Ahamkara means the I notion. Anahamkara means without the I notion. Without egotism. I'm the best. I'm a guru. I have realized the self. I am enlightened. If anyone ever talks like that, you kick them in the butt and run. Anyone who says I'm enlightened is a phony and a fraud. Nobody can say it, not out of humility, because it's true. Nobody has ever realized the self. So if anyone says, I'm enlightened, they're full of it. They're full of themselves. That's the key. Get out of town. If anyone says, I'm a jnani, I'm enlightened, I've realized the self, they don't know what they're talking about. The Upanishad says, it's unknown to him who thinks he knows it. You can't know it. No one ever knew it. And the person who thinks they know it is an ignorant person. Worse than ignorant. He's deluded himself and he's deluding his students. You can be sure he's a phony. In all of the writings of Shankaracharya, the greatest of Advaita Vedantins, never once did he say, I'm enlightened. In fact, he says, there may be some enlightened people, but for people like you and me, that's how Shankara talks, but for people like you and me, we have to do our sadhana. He puts himself in the category of the ignorant people, not out of humility, not that, oh, I'm enlightened, but I'm not going to tell anybody. He knows he's not enlightened. The ego can never be enlightened. I, Ira, will never be enlightened. Ira's not real. How can he be enlightened? And the self never has to be enlightened. So who's enlightened? So anyone who claims I'm enlightened is ignorant. I can go on with this, but that's enough for now.
What about moksha?
Oh, please. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
What about moksha? I mean, it's the core teaching in yoga that we aim for salvation. And
that's what I said.
And the word enlightenment is coming from Christianity. And yoga philosophy speaks about the samadhi or moksha. But, yeah, to my understanding, moksha, you can call it enlightenment. But can't we get it?
No.
Okay.
You're totally wrong. Let me explain. Do you know that Shankara had a guru?
Yes.
Do you know his name?
Gaudapada.
Very good. Very good study. Anyway, do you know Gaudapada wrote a commentary on the Mandukya Upanishad?
Yes.
And there's a famous verse, and it goes like this. Na utpatti na nirodha, na bada na sadhaka, na mamukshu na muktaha, iti esha paramartha. Listen very carefully. This is in English. There is no creation. There is no destruction. There is nobody bound. There is nobody practicing spiritual discipline. There is nobody who desires liberation, and there is nobody liberated. This is the highest truth. You know that verse? You've heard it? No.
But I know the thinking, it's like radical Advaita to say the world is not existent. It's, yeah, that there's only non-duality.
That's not radical Advaita, that's Advaita.
Yeah.
Anyone else that's teaching different is because they don't understand. In Advaita, there can be no wise men and ignorant men. If there were, duality would be true.
Yeah, but you also explained in, I saw one YouTube video where you explained that there's like the non-dual point of view, and there's also the duality which you can be caught in.
So, from the absolute point of view, that means the really real point of view, there's nobody who ever got enlightened.
Yeah.
There's nobody who was in ignorance. There's no gurus. There's no Vedanta. There's only the self, one without a second. That's the highest teaching of Vedanta. But in the relative point of view, the dualistic point of view, the point of view of ignorance, then we talk about people who know the truth, jnanis, people who are ignorant of the truth. But it's not the real truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's only for the purpose of teaching.
Oh.
It's not really true. That's, if the guru thinks that it's really true, it's because he doesn't understand Advaita.
No.
I'm going to explain this much more. Much more. And the second thing I'll just say, in Advaita Vedanta there's no samadhi. Samadhi is useless. If any guru tells you, I've had samadhi and I know the truth, he doesn't know Vedanta and he doesn't know the truth. Getting Shankaracharya in the Brahma Sutras says this about samadhi. He says, going into samadhi is just like going into deep sleep. You go into it ignorant, and you come out of it ignorant. It's of no use. For those of you who are interested, there's a book, it's called The Encyclopedia of Indian Philosophy. It's 26 volumes. In the 11th volume, I have an article. And the article is Why Samadhi is not only of no use in Vedanta, it's a defect. If you get Samadhi, it's a defect. It's no use because it doesn't remove your ignorance. Has anyone ever heard of Patanjali? He wrote a book called the Yoga Sutras. In that book, he says the yogi has to get nirvikalpa samadhi, the samadhi in which there are no vikalpas, no thoughts. All the subject and the object, everything is gone. When that yogi attains that state of samadhi in which all duality ceases, then he remains in his own true svarupa. And when he comes out of that, you know what Patanjali said? The world is real. He got samadhi, and he said the world was real. You know what else he said? You, who you are, Purusha, and you, Purusha, and you, Purusha, are all different. There are infinite Purushas, and each one is different. And there's a real world called Prakriti. Purushas are many. Prakriti is real. Nature is real. And there's a God, a special Purusha called Vishesha Purusha, called Ishvara, who's different than all the other Purushas. You'll never become Ishvara. He's a total dualist, through and through. Yoga Darshana is dualism. But he got Samadhi. Why didn't he realize non-dualism? Because samadhi is not the way to realize non-dualism. There's no benefit at all in it, but it's really a defect. What's the defect? Suppose I got samadhi, a special state that's very hard to get, and I got it. You haven't gotten it, right? So I know something that you don't know because I got samadhi. And unless you get samadhi, you won't know what I know. So you have to believe that because I got samadhi, I know the truth. And I'm going to teach you how to get samadhi so you can know the truth. But when you get samadhi, which is called chitta vritti nirodha, when all the vrittis, all the modifications of the mind has ceased, you won't know yourself. You won't know the oneness of reality. You won't know anything. Why would you think merely because you're not aware of the world has ceased? Patanjali didn't. When he came out of samadhi, the same world was there. He just said the Purusha is separate from Prakriti. But they're both real. He was a dualist. And if you think that you've got samadhi, you have to have the arrogance of thinking, I've had something special that you guys haven't. But Vedanta is not based on any special thing that I got. It's based on everybody's common experience. I tried to bring that out that first night. Vedanta is not based on any mystical experience. You don't have to get samadhi. It's of no use. It's a defect. And nowhere in the Upanishads does it say you have to get samadhi. Let me tell you a story. Sir.
Isn't it that samadhi helps you to burn the vasanas?
Samadhi just makes your ego bigger. Nothing more. It's of no use. You'll believe in duality. You'll think you're a big yogi. You'll take all the students in. You'll teach them how to get samadhi. They'll pay you for it too, believe me.
Yeah. So.
It's a big subject because almost all Advaita Vedantins in the modern time do teach that you must get samadhi. There are two books that have been ascribed to Shankaracharya that are not his works. One is called Viveka Chudamani. Anyone ever hear of this? The crest jewel of discrimination. Viveka, discrimination, Chudamani, crest jewel. It's ascribed to Shankara. In that book it says, studying the Upanishads will never bring the direct knowledge of the self. It'll only bring indirect knowledge. If you want the direct knowledge, you must get samadhi in the Viveka Chudamani. But in the Brahma Sutras, Shankara says, getting samadhi is of no benefit. You go into it ignorant, and you come out of it ignorant. They can't be the same author. This book was a 14th century book written 600 years after, but people think that it's his book. There's another famous book that people read called Panchadasi. You heard of Panchadasi? It's written by Vidyarayana, and in that book, the same business. Unless you get samadhi, there is no enlightenment. You must get samadhi. Merely listening to this teaching, it's words, words, words. You want the experience of non-duality, you must get samadhi. So everybody's shooting for samadhi. So they go and they join the yoga school, they take the yoga teacher training program. And they go, what is it? Yama, niyama, asana, that's pretty much, that's it. Asana, do they go, oh yeah, pranayama, okay. Pratyahara, who's up? And then, dharana, who's up to dharana? Raise your hand, anybody? How many people have a yoga certificate here? Did anyone get up to samadhi?
I didn't try.
You didn't even try. Get away. So, this is it. Nobody even tries for it. Nobody cares about it. It's a ridiculous state. Only the guru. Did your guru get samadhi?
I don't have a guru.
Oh. Well, usually if you have a teacher, you should ask them, excuse me, Guruji, have you gotten samadhi?
Well, I looked at them and the answer was there.
You knew they had samadhi?
No, I knew they didn't.
Oh, you knew they didn't. That's even better. If you ask a guru, have you gotten samadhi? He can, if he wants to be truthful with you, he'll either say yes or no. That's the only possibility. If he says no, then you say, then what are you talking about? You don't even, you're like me. You're just reading the book. If he says yes, then you say, oh, so you're enlightened. Then he'll say yes. Then you know he's a total phony. Then you know he's a total phony.
But there's moksha, is it?
What is Turiya?
Turiya is Atman. It's not a new state. It's not a state different than the three states. It's the truth of the three states. There's a famous Upanishad called the Mandukya Upanishad that examines the three states, and there they talk about Om, the very first mantra is Om Iti Etarakshram. All this is the syllable Om. All that was, all that is, all that will be. The second line says, all this is Brahman alone. That means Brahman and Om are the same. I am Atma Brahman, and that Brahman is the self. Atma Chatushtapat, and that self has four parts. Waking, dream, deep sleep, and then the fourth, Turiya. What is that Turiya? Is it something different than the three states? No. Are there three states in Turiya?
It's transcendent. I think it's not different.
It's not different.
It's one, but it's a state where I watch,
let me give you one example. I can explain it. That's why I'm sitting here. Suppose there's a rope on the floor, and you mistake it as a snake, or a stick, or a garland. There's only one thing there, rope. But you think it's a snake. You think it's a garland. You think it's a stick. The snake is waking. The stick is dream, and the garland is deep sleep. The fourth is the rope. Are there four things there? There's only one thing there. The fourth thing is the only reality there. What you call the snake is the rope. What you call the garland is the rope. What you call the stick is the rope. What you call waking is Turiya. What you call dream is Turiya. If there were really three states and a transcendent Turiya, would non-duality be true? There'd be three states, there's duality, and then something beyond that. Turiya is not another state, it's the truth of the three states. It's you that appear as waking. That's the Turiya. Turiya is Atma. Samadhi is like deep sleep. I'm going to get to this subject much deeper than we have a couple of days, so I don't want to do the whole thing in just one thing here. I'm trying to unfold it in a way that everybody can follow and kind of get the whole Vedantic package. So we'll leave Turiya alone for now. We'll leave Moksha alone for now. Remember when I said a student has to have a burning desire for liberation, moksha? But I'm saying there's no moksha. That's why Vedanta is not for everybody. Seems contradictory, but there's no contradiction. I'll unfold it and you'll see. Okay, let's go continue with the qualifications here. So, Indriyarteshu Vairagyam, this is the eighth. Anahamkara, without egotism. And the next one is very interesting. Janma Mrityo Jaravyadi Dukadosha Anudarshanam. A person who wants to study Vedanta should see the dosha, the defect, in birth, in death, in old age and disease. That there's a defect in this birth. The main defect of birth is death. Everything that's born must die. Everything that has a beginning comes to an end. If it's in time, it comes and it goes. It's impermanent. So this birth, Janma, is a defect. And death is definitely a defect. I don't want to die. Jara, old age. Some of you are young here and old age is waiting for you. Unavoidable. You will get older and that's a defect. You'll lose a lot of things that your youth has. Jara, Vyadi, and as you get older, you're going to get sick. The doctor's going to find something on that x-ray. Something's coming up, it's just waiting. Nobody gets out of here alive. Vyadi, this is the nature of once I'm this body. I'm born, I die, I'm old age. It's all a defect. I want to get out of it. Seeing the defect in this birth and death. Not seeing birth as a great thing. The only great thing about it is that in this very birth I can come to realize the fact that I'm birthless. Janma Mrityo Jaravyadi Dukadosha Anadarshanam. Asaktir, unattached, Vairagya. Asaktir Anapishvangaha Putra Dara Grahadishu. Anabhishvangaha, without an extreme identification is called anabhishvangaha. With what? Putra, the children. When my child graduated from college, oh man, I did great. I identify with the children, but a Vedantin tries to thin that out, not extremely identified with the children, putra, dara, the wife. When the wife's happy, I'm happy. Happy wife, happy life. It's my wife. So, and we can reverse it. Happy husband, happy wife. That attachment to the spouse, abhinishvangaha, thinning that out, making it not so strong that whatever happens to them, you feel that has happened to you. That's called abhishvangaha putra dara grahadishu. Nityam cha samachittatvam, always having equanimity of mind. Nitya, always. Sama, the same. Chitta, the mind. Nitya cha samachittatvam, that equanimity of mind. It's the same as that samadhana that I mentioned before. When ishta anishta upapadishu, whether what comes is what you desired, ishta, or whether what comes is anishta, not desired. Sometimes things come that are desired, and what happens? I'm elated. What happens when the things come that I didn't want? Anishta, I become dejected. This is called sukhi dukhi. He's not a yogi. He's affected. But the yogi, the one who wants to get this knowledge, is nitya cha samachittatvam. His mind is always equanimous, regardless of what's coming, the good or the bad. 10. If you really study these qualities, there's actually, they're getting tougher and tougher as they progress. The next one is even harder. Mayi cha ananya yogena. Mayi, in me, that supreme reality, Paramatma. Mayi, in me, ananya yoga, unswerving yoga. The word yoga does not mean putting your legs behind your head or contorting your body. In the Bhagavad Gita, yoga, the word yoga comes from the Sanskrit root yuj. Yuj means to join. To join is yoga. When you join your mind with that inner witness, Paramatma, that's called mayi, in me, that supreme reality, ananya yoga, joining it and not to any other thing, ananya, not any other, ananya, not something other, yoga, joining, mayi, joining your mind to me, mayi cha ananya yogena bhaktir avibhicharani, bhaktir. Bhaktir means bhakti. The word bhakti in Sanskrit means, it has a particular meaning. If I love my children, that's not bhakti. And I do love my children. And if I love my wife, I love my wife, but that's not bhakti. When that love, prem, is directed towards that inner witness, that Krishna, that supreme being. When that love is turned towards that, when there is a passionate love for that, an unswerving love for that, that's called bhakti. Love of the supreme is bhakti. Abhibhicharani means it doesn't swerve. It's just like when you love your wife. When you go to work, you still love your wife. When you have a lover, you go to work, you're thinking about your lover. What is she doing? Boy, I can't wait till I get home. I can see her again. I'll be with her. I want to be with her. Even when you're not, the mind is always on that. That's called bhakti ravibhicharani, that extreme love for that reality, your own self, falling in love with yourself, the true self, that supreme being. That's called bhakti. It's absolutely necessary. Without bhakti, there's no chance. The highest sadhana is bhakti. Krishna says in the Gita, Bhaktya eva mam abhijanati. By bhakti alone you will come to know me. By bhakti alone. Mat bhakta buddhiyogam dadami. I give my bhakta, the one who's devoted to me, who's in love with me, who's turned his mind towards me, who's thinking of me, who wants to join with me. That bhakta, I give him the ability to come to know me. No one else except my bhakta gets that capacity. The person who's in love with money, I don't reveal myself to him. The person who's filled with greed and anger and hate and jealousy and avarice, he can't. He's in love with something else. But my bhakta, buddhi yogam, I give him the buddhi yoga, the yoga of discrimination, the capacity to see who's the witness and what's the witnessed, who is the supreme unchanging reality and what is changing. That capacity, I only give that to my bhakta. He gets my grace. I shed my grace on my bhakta. Does that mean that the Supreme Being doesn't shed his grace on everybody? He does, but only the bhakta gets it. It's kind of like this. Make believe we're all boats, little boats on the ocean. Yeah? And we're just floating around in the ocean. And there's wind that's blowing on top of the ocean. But only the boat that puts up the sail gets the wind. God's grace is available to everyone. But unless we put up that sail of turning our mind towards Him, we don't get His grace. He sheds His grace on His bhaktas. He reveals Himself. When you become devoted to that, in love with that, with the mind wanting that, then that reality shines forth. It gets revealed. It's always revealed, but only the bhakta, like the boat that's lifted its sail, gets that grace. The grace of the Supreme Being is shed on the bhaktas only. Now that sounds pretty theological, doesn't it? Sorry about that. No? Okay.
Very practical.
Very practical. You can think about that. Bhakti Ravibhicharani, unswerving devotion. And then, should you go to an ashram if you want this knowledge? Should you go to a workshop? What does Krishna say? Vivikta Desha Sevitum. You should retire to a secluded place. You know what happens in the ashram? The same thing that was happening outside the ashram. No difference. It's even worse in the ashram. Oh, you didn't do your seva. Oh, Guruji spent more time with you than me? Are you kidding? What kind of karma yoga is that? Yep.
Same crap, because it's here.
Krishna doesn't say go to an ashram. Find yourself a secluded place. Vivikta Desha Sevitum. Arati Janasamsati, with a distaste for the society of worldly people. Why? What are worldly people going to be talking about?
Crap.
How much money they're making, what type of vacation they went on. Did you see my new boat? I just got this is because that's what's on their mind. It's natural. That's called jana, the ordinary worldly people whose desires are for worldly things. A distaste for that, because when you hang around with people like that, they will draw your mind out. Your mind, oh, hey, that is a nice boat. Maybe I should get one. Immediately, you're off to the races. When you retire to a quiet place, and the only people that you like to associate with are who? Other people that share your interest. Other people that also want this. That's called satsang. Joining with other people that want sat reality. Those people are beneficial to your sadhana. But worldly people, they'll just take your mind out, because what they want is not what you want. So Krishna says, Vivikta Desha Sevitum, retiring to a secluded place, Arati Janasamsati. Now, most of us can't retire to a secluded place. We have a house, we have family maybe, you may have be married. So how do you retire to a quiet place? That quiet place could be a room in your house. It doesn't have to be in a cave in the Himalayas. It doesn't have to be on the banks of some river somewhere. In your very house, you make yourself a little room. And when you shut that door, that's Vivikta Desha. And in that room, you do your sadhana with no distractions. As long as there's distractions, the mind will go out. You try to find yourself a quiet place. You put up a picture of something. You put up an om, something. You light some incense, so that the mind goes in a direction that's different than worldly. And then if people come and they want to come there, let them come and share with you this subject matter. Even for a short time, whatever we can do, it may not be much, but that's the requirement. Find yourself a quiet place. Try to keep away from people that are going to drag your mind out. Vivikta Desha Sevitum Arati Jana Samsati. And then the last verse, and this is the hardest of all. Adhyatma Jnana Nityatvam. Adhyatma? Adhyatma. Atma is the self. Adhyatma means the inner self, the most in. Not this outer self, not the senses which are more in, not the mind which is more in, not the ego which is more in, but that witnessing consciousness that's even more in, that objectifies the ego, that adhyatma, adhyatma jnana, that knowledge of the inner self, adhyatma jnana, nityatvam, constantly engaged in that knowledge about my inner self, constantly bringing the mind back to that. That's bhakti also. Constantly, over and over, adhyatma jnana, nityatvam. Nitya means what? Always. It doesn't mean from 9 to 10 I'm going to do this and then after that I got another program. Whatever you're doing, whatever you're working, whatever you're eating, sleeping, every activity, you can be involved in this knowledge of the inner self. It doesn't It doesn't mean in order to do that you have to sit in full lotus and stop moving. That's not Adhyatma Jnana. How long can you sit like that? Even if you got good knees, after a while. The Nityatvam means while you're doing everything. Krishna says, even while engaged in action, he does nothing. Karmani abhi pravritto api nakim chit karomi. Even while engaged in action, he would think, I do nothing. Karmani akarma yaha pashet. He who sees no action in the action, while you're doing the action, I see no action at all. Sa buddhiman. He is a wise man and not the one who thinks that he's a doer. So this Adhyatma Jnana is not a meditation that you do only in the morning. It's a constant reflection on this jnana, this knowledge about the self that you heard about from the scripture and the teacher. Constantly bringing the mind back to that. You can imagine how hard that is. The mind doesn't want to go there. It really doesn't. It wants to go out and enjoy. To take that mind and restrain it and... Because the mind is convinced the happiness is out there. As long as that's the case, it's going to run out there. It's not until it's absolutely convinced there's not a drop of happiness. What I call happiness is really the source of suffering. Dukkha yoni, Krishna calls it, those enjoyments that come from the contacts of the senses with the sense objects are nothing but the womb of suffering. Why? Antavanta, they have a beginning and an end. When we realize that there's no eternal happiness out there, then the mind, because the mind wants happiness, when it and it thinks that's where the happiness is, when the mind is convinced no happiness there, then it begins to look in other places. And that true happiness that it's been looking for can only be found when it turns to that Adhyatma, that inner self, that knowledge of the inner self. Adhyatma Jnana Nityatvam. And the very last thing is the whole culmination of all of this business. The very first thing is humility. It starts with Amanitvam, humility. The most important spiritual sadhana is humility. Thinking that I'm something special is the bondage. This I that we're so identified with, that feels so proud about ourselves. Boy, I'm pretty good at that. This has to be made little to understand what a rascal this ego is, what a phony and a fraud, what a hypocrite. You have to really examine yourself truthfully and honestly. See the truth of your, of this little ego of yours, and make it less and less and less. I am nothing. I am like a piece of dust on the lotus feet of the Supreme Being. That feeling should come over us. I'm nothing. I know little. I'm filled with desires. I'm so jealous of these other people that have all those things. I want that. This guy has to be made little. That Amanitva is a real... And so, if you see somebody who doesn't have humility, and you can see that very easy, I'm a jnani. I'm enlightened. I had samadhi. I'm the guru. Don't fool with me. This guy has no humility. You should run. No, no, it's okay. Thank you. So you can study these qualities They hold up a light for us. They're kind of like a measuring rod to see where we are in our sadhana. Do I have humility? Am I boasting? Are my senses just running wild? Do I really have devotion to that? Do I see the defect in birth and death and old age and disease and I want some way out? All of those qualities lead to this final thing, which in Sanskrit is Tattva-jnana Artha-darshanam. Tattva-jnana. Tattva means truth. Jnana means knowledge. Tattva-jnana, the knowledge of that truth. Artha, that very object, which is the object of the knowledge of truth. That artha, darshanam. Anyone know what the word darshanam means?
Vision.
Vision. Seeing. Directly seeing that object like the berry on the palm of your hand. Direct. Sakshat. Aparokshat. Not indirect. That's called darshana. All of those sadhanas are necessary according to Krishna, according to Vyasa. If you want this knowledge, if you want this darshana, you must get those qualities. And by the way, if you're lucky enough to find a real guru, he will have all of those qualities. But the difference between us and that guru is this. We have to make great efforts to try to get those qualities. But the guru has those qualities with no effort at all. He's not trying to become humble. He's not trying to control the senses. These are all just natural to him. He makes no effort for this. For us, in Sanskrit it's called Yat sadhya siddhaha tat sadhana sadhakaha. That which is natural for a siddha. A siddha is a perfected sage. That which is natural for the siddha is sadhana, spiritual practice for the sadhakaha, for the spiritual practitioner. We have to make that a sadhana to try to become humble, to try to control our senses, to try to see the defect in the objects outside, to try to turn our minds back to see that inner self, to try to always have the mind in that direction. That's bhakti. To have that bhakti unswerving, to have that devotion so strong that the mind has lost all interest in everything else. Then, artha darshanam. You see that object directly. And then Krishna sums up the whole thing. He says, etat jnanam, that darshana, etat jnanam, that is knowledge, iti proktam, which I have proclaimed. All of those sadhanas are knowledge. Why? Because they lead to knowledge. Etat jnanam iti proktam. Ajnanam yatato anyata. And that which is opposite than this will only lead you to ignorance. What's the opposite of humility? Lack of humility. What's the lack of the opposite of no controlling the control of the senses? Your senses are out of control. What's the opposite of seeing the in other words, whatever is the opposite of these qualities is nothing but ignorance, because it leads to ignorance. But this is knowledge. These qualities are the divine qualities, the spiritual qualities that every sadhaka, this is not like studying algebra in school. This is not like memorizing some facts and spitting it out on a test. It's not an intellectual pursuit where you get some type of intellectual satisfaction. The mind gets satisfied when it gets all the answers to its questions. If it doesn't get the answers, then it's not satisfied. But spiritual bliss is not about intellectual satisfaction. It won't do you any good. What we need is spiritual satisfaction. In order to get spiritual satisfaction, it's not the intellect, it's the capacity of our minds to turn inwards and see that truth directly. No logic, no reasoning. Seeing the truth of the matter, that will bring the spiritual satisfaction. The mind has many faculties: emotional, intellectual, memory, the faculty of memory. But it also has another faculty. It's kind of like this. Our minds are like, you know, when you go into a restaurant and there's the kitchen and they have that door that's on a hinge and that door goes this way and this way, right? They go into the kitchen, then they come out with the food, they bring. So that door can go outward and inwards. Our minds are like that door, and generally speaking, the mind is like that. But the mind does have the capacity to do this. It does have the faculty, the capacity. That capacity of the mind to turn inwards, to see the self directly, is called the spiritual faculty of the mind. That's the faculty, not the intellectual faculty, but the faculty that allows us to have darshana, to see the truth directly. That's the faculty that we have to develop, that spiritual faculty. You won't get it if you don't have humility, because then you'll be identified with this ego. The mind can't turn in if you're identified with this ego. The mind can't turn in if it's running after the objects of desire. That faculty of the human mind, the capacity to turn inwards, is the spiritual faculty of the mind. That's what we have to use when we're listening to this teaching. If you don't use this faculty, you'll have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm assuming that while I talk, for a moment, you yourself are kind of saying, is that true? Am I the witness of my thoughts? Is my true self different from my ego? In order to see what I'm talking about, you have to turn inwards. And suppose you say, you go like this, ah, I see what that guy's talking about. I am the witness of every thought, of every state. Everything is appearing and disappearing to me. Yes, I can see that. How do you see it? How do you see it? Do you see it like you see this book? How do you see that when you go, ah, I see that? What does it mean? You intuit directly this truth. The intuition, we call this talk, I don't know if you saw in the thing there, was called the intuition of reality. We have to intuit this truth in our own experience. That self doesn't need anything to light it up. If I want to know the book, I need my eyes. If I want to know the feel of this pants, I need my touch. If I want to hear what the sound is, I need. But to know the self, what reveals the self? Nothing is needed. It's ever shining. It's ever present. It's never hidden. Nothing is needed to make it known. It's the light in which everything is known. That shining, everything shines. It's the light that lights up the light and that lights up the darkness. It's beyond light and darkness. The supreme light of the self. You have to intuit this in your own experience. See the truth of it in your own experience. That's called darshana. It doesn't mean seeing something outside. Like we see, we have darshan of a murti in a temple. That's darshan. But the darshan of the self is not that. It's the direct intuition. Let me ask you a question. Think about this. How do we see the dream? Do you see it with these eyes? The sounds in the dream, do you hear it with these ears? How do you see the dream? With no instruments, no sense organs, nothing is needed. You're the light that lights up the whole dream. Nothing. And how do you know that you're the knower of the dream? How do you know that? Do you need some means of knowledge? Or is it sakshat, direct and immediate? That I'm the knower of the dream is self-evident, self-revealed, self-established. That's how we know the self, with no means whatsoever. You don't need any instruments, because the self is self-revealed. It's the light that doesn't need any other light to light it up. The thoughts need a light because they're insentient. They come and they go. But the light that lights up the thoughts, do you need another light to light that light up? It's self-lit. It's self-evident. It's self-revealed. There's nothing so obvious. Once you turn that mind in, there's nothing so near, so close, so obvious, because it's your own self. But as long as the mind is out, there's nothing so far away, so hidden, so unknowable than your own self. All of Vedanta is this spiritual journey, the real journey of turning the mind in and directly intuiting this truth for yourself. All of these sadhanas, all of the sadhanas that Shankara said is merely for this, giving us the capacity. Because when we turn the mind in, that teaching, you are that, becomes so obvious, so free from all doubts, that the conviction, I am that, is so strong that you can't even imagine that there could be anything that could ever remove that wisdom. There can never be any doubt about the self, because even to have a doubt, the self has to be there lighting up the doubt. I'm the witness. You're the witness of that thought. I'm not the witness. You're the witness of that thought. You can't negate your own self. It's always there. It's there during the waking. It's there during the dream. When the waking and dream are not appearing, how do you know they're not appearing? Because I'm the self. And my experience is, they're not appearing. I'm unaffected by whatever appears. I'm unattached, ever pure, ever free, ever awake. I never woke up. When the waking state came, I never woke up. When the waking went away, I didn't go to sleep. Gone. Came and went. To intuit this fact is called Atmagyana, the knowledge of the self. The purpose of the guru is to take your mind, throw it in. That's what he really does. That's all that he can do. And then you have to see the truth for yourself. The guru can't make you see this. He can give you that inward turn, point you in that direction. But in the end, it's you who have to realize this for yourself. You can't believe it because the guru said it, or some scripture said it, or having faith that, oh, when I die, maybe I'll realize. You have to realize it yourself here and now. That's Vedanta. When I realize I am that, that's who I am. If anybody here could actually do that, I am that. That knowledge will remove the misconception that I am this. If I'm that, I'm not this. That was a mistake. It was a misconception. It was avidya, nothing but ignorance. I was always that. Even when I took myself to be this, I am that. Okay. So those are the qualifications. Bhagavad Gita 7 through 11, the Brahma Sutras, the very first sutra. If you read it, you'll see what the qualifications are. I told you who the guru is. He's the one who knows how to teach this thing, and he's the one whose mind is established in that truth. So when he speaks, unlike a pundit or a professor or someone who studied these things and could teach it in the university, unlike that, the guru is someone who's speaking from his own experience. So the words of a guru, of a real guru, a real teacher, they ring with conviction. They have a virya, a power to them that's different than when you listen to a professor. Because you know he's talking from his own experience. And those words are charged with the capacity to take the student's mind and throw it back, even if he doesn't want to. The guru, in fact, if you're really a qualified student, doesn't even have to open his mouth. He can just look at you, and with his gaze, that truth is revealed for the real student who has all of those qualities. There's a story in the Upanishads that says there was a person who wanted to realize the truth. And he traveled. He heard there was this wonderful guru up in the Himalayas. And he went from the south of India and went all the way up there. He located this guy. He walked in. He prostrates at the feet of the guru. And he says, Guruji, please teach me the truth. And the guru sat there silent. Didn't say anything. He says, Guruji, I've come all the way from the south. It's been such a long journey. Could you please teach me the truth? The guru sits there, totally silent. But the third time he says, Guruji, I don't understand. Why don't you teach me the truth? I've come all this way. I'm a sincere student. They said, if I'm a sincere student and I went to you, you would teach me. And the guru looked at him and said, I have been teaching you. There is no higher teaching than silence. The self is silence. I've been teaching you all along, but you just weren't qualified to understand. The highest teaching is silence. All the jabba 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 is for the lower students. Because the self is silence. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. That Shanti doesn't mean peace of mind. Shanti doesn't mean peace of mind. Shanti is the nature of the self. The peace when there's no mind, that's Shanti. That's the Shanti that Guru was teaching that student, but he wasn't qualified. He said, I am teaching you. There is no higher teaching than silence. But if we go to a teacher and he sits quiet, it'll be of no benefit to people like us. We'll have to go somewhere else. We can't understand that teaching. So when this Bhagavad Gita, 13th chapter, begins with Idam Shariram Kauteya, this body, Arjuna, is like a field. He who knows it, the witness, is called the witness of the field. And then the next verse, Shatragnya cha pimam vidhi. Know me. Know that Shatragnya in you to be me in all the Kshetras. That's the exact teaching of the Upanishads. There's no difference. That you are that tattvamasi is the same as the witness in you is that Supreme Krishna, the Supreme Being, Paramatma, that Vishnu that pervades everything. That witness in you is the unchanging reality. Krishna says, you should know that to be me. And the one who has this knowledge, what is Kshetra? And what is the witness of the Kshetra? The Kshetra means the body, the senses, the mind, and the ego. It's the Sharira. That's the Kshetra. The field is this body, mind, senses, and ego that I'm totally identified with. But Krishna says, the knower of all of that in you is me. The true nature of that witness is me. You should know that. Mam vidhi. When you know what is the witness and what is the witness, instead of mixing them up in our ignorance, when you know what is the object, what is the subject, that knowledge, kshetra kshetranya, what is the field, who's the knower of the field, jnanam, Etatyanam matam mama. That's what I consider to be the knowledge. That's the knowledge. There's no other knowledge. Who am I and what is this? That discriminative knowledge, when the mind becomes pure and introvert and subtle, it can discriminate what is the self and what is the not self. When the mind is filled with vairagya, equanimity, introversion, when that mind is like that, it can see very clearly that the whole world is an object to me. My body is an object to me. My ego is an object to me. I am the unchanging awareness that is unaffected by the appearance or disappearance of anything. I'm ever free, ever pure, ever awake, unchanging, infinite bliss. That's my eternal nature. To discriminate and see the truth of those claims is called Atmajnana. To realize that I am immortal. I was never born. I don't get old, sick, or die. I'm not in time. I'm the witness of time. Time appears in the waking state. I'm the witness of the waking. When the waking time goes, dream time appears. I'm the witness of the dream. When they both go, I'm not aware of any time. I'm not in time. Time is an appearance to me. It's just an illusion. Time is a dream. It comes and goes with the waking state. Dream time comes and goes with the dream. But I, the witness of both, am not in time, and therefore I never change. I am unborn. Let me tell you a story. Take a little break. This is a good story for the ladies in the audience, because it shows that this is from the oldest Upanishad ever written. They say 800 BC. Before, like I said, long before Buddhism, somebody was running around India telling this story. There was a time in India when even the kings wanted to get this knowledge. Even the kings, who had all of the pleasures that money and power, they still wanted to get this knowledge. There was one king by the name of Janaka. He was like the empire. He had a whole empire. King Janaka said, I want to know who's the wisest man in my kingdom. I'm going to have a debate. And I'm going to send out messages to all the corners of my empire that we're having a debate. Whoever wants to participate is invited. And we're going to find out who's the wisest man in my kingdom. And not only that, the winner of this debate is going to win 1,000 cows, and on each horn of those two horns, on each cow, there's going to be 5 kilos of gold. That means 10 kilos, 20 pounds in America. 20 pounds of gold on each, so 1,000 cows, 20,000 pounds of gold. It's a big thing. So he put out the thing, and sure enough, everybody started coming. Hundreds of people attended for the debate, and they begin. So in order to have the debate, what they did was they divided themselves up into groups. And if you won your group, then you survived, everyone else left. And that guy who won that group, he survived. And if you read the Upanishad, it's very interesting. They describe the debates. I won't get into all of it. But slowly, slowly, it gets narrowed down. And then there's just a few people left. There was this woman, Gargi, and two others, and this guy by the name of Yajnavalkya. And in the end, Yajnavalkya wins the debate. He's the wisest guy in Janaka's kingdom. He defeated everybody. So Janaka goes up to him and says, Yajnavalkya, you are the wisest man in my kingdom. You are the true knower of Brahman. You are the knower of absolute truth. I'm going to give you your 1,000 cows with 20,000 pounds of gold. So Yajnavalkya says, you know, King Janaka, I'm getting old now, and I don't think I have much use for this. I'm not going to accept your prize. I'm going to give it to my wives. What? I'm going to give the prize to my wives. Wives. He had two wives. The wisest guy in the kingdom is married to two ladies. That shows what? You can be a wise man and have two wives. It's pretty good, right? You don't have to be a monk, a celibate monk. You could have two wives and be the wisest man, the person who knows Brahman. So he says, I'm going to give it to the two wives. He calls the two wives up. The two wives, one wife is called Katyayana, and the other was called Maitreyi. And he goes to Katyayana, he says, Katyayana, my dear wife, I am now going off into the forest, but I'm going to give you 500 cows with 1,000 pounds of gold. You will be an extremely rich lady. You'll have everything that you want. You'll be well taken care of. Katyayana looks at her husband and says, Yajnavalkya, you are so generous and so wonderful. I've always loved you, and I wish you well in the forest. Have a good trip. He turns to the other wife, Maitreyi. He says, Maitreyi, I'm giving you 500 cows with 1,000 pounds of gold. You'll have everything you need. You'll be well taken care of. I wish you well. And Maitreya looks at him and says, Yajnavalkya, before I accept these 500 cows, I just want to ask you one question. If I accept these 500 cows with all this gold, will I attain immortality? Yajnavalkya says, you'll be very comfortable. You'll have a house, you'll have servants, you'll have all the food, you can have a chariot, you'll have everything you need, Maitreya. No. I'm asking you one question, Yajnavalkya. Will I become immortal? And he looks at her, he says, I'm sorry, my dear wife. Even if you accept these cows, you won't be immortal. And Maitreya looks at the husband and says, then keep your damn cows. I want immortality. Yajnavalkya looks at him and says, Maitreya, you've always been dear to me. But today, you are more dear to me than ever before. Come, sit by my side. I will give you immortality. And he begins to teach. I'm not going to tell you the teaching, what he taught her. But I will tell you at the end, Maitreya looks at the husband and says, thank you, my dear Yajnavalkya. You've bestowed upon me immortality. And the dialogue ends. What does it show? That a woman who's never done any sadhana, she's a wife of this guy, but because she had that dispassion, she wanted immortality. I would have taken the cows. Be truthful. Who wouldn't take the immortality? It's so abstract. But she had that vairagya. She had that burning desire to attain immortality. She didn't want to die. It shows that even in ancient times, women could become enlightened, not just men. Because there is some story that, oh, you have to be reborn as a man first before you could become enlightened. Has anyone heard this business? Well, the Upanishad says that's not the case. It's the same self in everybody. Everybody has the same immortal self. So anybody who realizes it becomes immortal. It has nothing to do with a man or a woman. It has to do with our desire to get that immortality. The dispassion for the riches of the world, realizing they won't bring me that. This is the stories that were running around 8th century BC. It's pretty amazing. A man with two wives is enlightened, and a woman who's never done any sadhana, but she had that vairagya, that dispassion, when she heard this teaching. It's a very beautiful teaching. I'll tell you a little bit about it. Just the beginning of the teaching. Here's how he begins the teaching. He says, Maitreya, the husband is not dear to the wife the wife is not dear for the sake of the wife, but because it's my wife. The children are not dear for the sake of the children, but because they're my children. The money is not dear for the sake of the money, but they're dear because it's my money. Everything is dear for the sake of the self. The self is the most lovable. Everything we love is because we love ourselves. That self, drashtavyaha, must be seen. Shrotavya, it has to be heard about. Mantavya, it has to be reflected on. Nanityastavya, It has to be contemplated on. Shravana, manana, nidhyasana. That's where that comes from. Yajnavalkya's teaching to Maitreyi. You have to hear about this. A teacher has to tell you about it. And when you hear about it, then you yourself have to reflect on it. I'm hoping that when this talk is over, and maybe when you go to your room or when you're sitting, that you think about what is being discussed here. It has to be reflected on, manana. And then, nididhyastavya. The mind should become totally directed towards that. That's called meditation. If you read the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, you'll understand what meditation is. It's not Patanjali meditation. It's totally different. That turning back of the mind is called nididhyasya. If you can just reflect and get it, you don't have to do that. Because by reflecting, you realize I have no mind. So why turn it back? But if you can't do that, for the most people like us, me, we have to take our mind and turn it inwards. For the Uttama Adhikari, for the highest student who has these qualities, all he has to do is hear the teaching, Shravana. At the very time of hearing, he understands it and there's nothing more to be done. If you've heard it, but you still feel like I'm in the world, then you have to reflect on it. And even after reflecting, if you can't get it, then you're going to have to meditate on it, contemplate on it, a special type of contemplation. It's taught in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It's a very, very difficult thing, this meditation. Only those people who have already graduated to a certain level of spiritual competence can even do this business. So I'm not saying that we can do it or you can do it. I can't do it. I'm absolutely honest with you. I can't do it. Not only can't I do it, I don't want to do it. It's too difficult. But if you read the sixth chapter of the Gita, you'll see what's involved. So that's what's necessary. If you've heard this teaching, and for a moment you think, the witness. When I first heard about the witness, it was with Swami Dayananda, and he was teaching about the witness. I'd never heard about this before. And when he taught this witness, he had the capacity to take your mind, and that witness was so obvious. And when I'd walk out of the lecture hall, I would say, Ira, no matter what, if you forget everything, just don't forget the witness. Don't forget the witness. It blew my mind. I was like, this is why I came to India. This is what I was looking for. There it is. Plain as day. I'm the witness. I'm free. I'm awake. I'm bliss. Wow. Thank you, Swami Dayananda. What a revelation. Something that I... Because let me... And that witness, I'm always that. That's my nature. I don't get it. I can't lose it. I can't forget it. I can't remember it. Because it's the self. You can forget everything but the self, because it's in the light of the self that you forget, you remember. But the self neither forgets or remembers. So it was so amazing to me, because here was my problem. I'll share a little bit personal. 5 minutes. I'm a product of the 60s. I'm an original hippie. You've heard of the hippies? Of course. 1967, 1968, 1969, Woodstock Festival.
We like it.
You've heard it and you know about it? Yeah. So I was one of the original people in that group there. I lived in the Lower East Side in 1965. I started taking psychedelics, mushrooms, LSD, peyote, any psychedelic I could get to change my consciousness. And I was having all sorts of what I thought was spiritual experiences when I took these drugs. I'd take the drug and I would feel time is an illusion. You know, you're on the drug and you look at your watch. You really, time? What's that? That doesn't make sense. So, and you have an experience that, like, your ego dissolves and you feel like you're one with everything. And everything's perfect. Everything's perfect, always and forever. Time is an illusion. Everything's like a trip. It's all a trip. It's like a dream. But as soon as the drug would wear off and I'd come down, I'd lose it. Here I am again, back to square one. Take some more LSD, go up, come down, lose it. I once took an LSD trip and I wrote myself a poem. Listen to this poem. I was 18 when I wrote this. The name of the poem is called It. Oh, you foolish men who seek it through inspection, know you not that all is lost with but a moment's reflection? It has to be caught within the midst, for nowhere else does it exist. So burn your books to cinder and dust. Abandon the search completely, you must. Then the time will be fit for you to know you've always been one with it. LSD poem. Sounds like Vedanta, yeah? And I didn't know any Vedanta. But I came down. I had another experience where I was peeking on this drug and the sun just came up and I looked out of the window and there was a tree. And on the branch, there was a bluebird. And I looked at it. And I'm just staring. And the bluebird is perfectly still. And then, in the blink of an eye, it went, psh! And when the bluebird flew off, somehow I realized everything is always perfect. Everything is open. And I wrote down on a piece of paper, Ira, you knew what the Buddha knew. Everything is always perfect. You're going to forget this. But it doesn't matter. Believe me. Even if you forget it, everything is always perfect. I wrote this down because I knew I was not going to remember this. So the next day, I see the paper. Everything is always perfect. Made no sense. So the idea was I kept coming up and going down. I wanted to get it and not lose it. And then I started reading books by Ramana Maharshi. Anybody hear of Ramana Maharshi? So in 1968, I started studying Ramana Maharshi. And what they said was that when Ramana Maharshi realized the self, he never lost it. He got it. And he never lost it. It's called Sahaja Samadhi. It's a samadhi in which you're always in it. Has people here been to Ramana's ashram in Tiru? So you know in the samadhi hall, there's a thing on the wall. It says the description of Ramana's enlightened experience in his own words. You know this thing? So it says there that he says, so I wanted to know what death was, and I made myself into rigor mortis, And I realize when I'm dead, I won't be aware of the space or time of the world. Remove that. When I'm dead, I won't be aware of this body. Remove that. When I'm dead, I won't have sense organs. Remove that. When I'm dead, I won't even have a mind. Remove that. When I'm dead, even this eye won't be there. Remove that. And when he removed every single phenomena, he says, I then realized that I am that eternal, immortal consciousness, which is the ever-present reality. And from that day on, whether feeding the cows, talking to the people, or reading the newspaper, I never lost touch with that. I said, wow. He got it and he never lost it. I'm going to find somebody like that. This drug business is not working. So with that, I put the book, Who Am I, in the back of my backpack. And I got a one-way ticket from New York to Luxembourg. This was right after the 1969 Woodstock Folk Festival. I said, that's it, I'm going to India. I'm going to find someone like Ramana Maharshi, and he's going to tell me how I can get it and not lose it. I told my parents, I'm going to India, I want to get it and not lose it. They said, you need a psychiatrist. But nevertheless, so I went to Luxembourg and I hitchhiked and I went overland. I had $400 and a one-way ticket to Luxembourg, and I was going to find Ramana Maharshi or die. That was the idea. Somebody, he was dead. I'm not going to find Ramana. I'm going to find somebody like Ramana Maharshi who can tell me how I can get it and never lose it. So that was the idea. I won't tell you how it all unfolded, but somehow I wound up at the feet of Swami Dayananda. And he pointed out, you're the witness. You never get it, you never lose it. And it answered my question. How you don't get the witness, you don't lose the witness, it's your eternal nature. You don't go up, you don't come down. When he taught me that, the gratitude to Swami Dayananda, that's it, that's the answer. You don't get it and lose it. I'm the eternal witness. Ira, don't forget the witness. And that was the beginning of my Vedantic studies. I went on from there because Swami Dayananda had some misconceptions about Vedanta himself. But that's another discussion. But he was the beginning for me. And he introduced me to this concept of the witness, Sakshi, the direct seer that doesn't need any sense organs to see. It sees without any need for any instruments. That's Sakshi, Sakshat Akshi. The direct seer is called Sakshi, the witness. That was the beginning, and I kept reflecting on this. It's now 50 years later, and I'm still blown away by this idea. It's the unique teaching of the Upanishads that there's a witness different from the ego that's in everybody, that's the true self. That teaching, that Vedantic teaching, you can't get it in Buddhism, Judaism, Sufism, rationalism, scientism, empiricism. Nobody teaches this, knows this, even criticizes it because they don't even know it. This unique teaching that there's only one reality without a second, that witness is the only reality. He's not even a witness. The witness is not a witness. If the witness really witnessed something, wouldn't duality be true? What kind of witness in non-duality? What are you talking about, a witness? Are you really the witness? Why do they call the self the witness? I'm going to leave that hanging to think about it. We have 10 minutes. I'm going to open it up for the first time to questions. I'm hoping somebody has some questions. I've been talking for 5 hours now. Any questions? Not one question. I must be very clear. How about an objection? Sorry, sir, I don't agree with what you're saying. Yeah.
Satchit Ananda. I'm going along with the Satchit thing, but why is there Ananda? Why is this all together? It seems to be, I mean, I know that Ananda is not like a psychical mental phenomenon, why is it so glued together? It seems to be different things that are one, but I don't get this. Why is there bliss in it?
Let me see. So that absolute reality we call Sat Chit Ananda. But are these three different qualities of reality? Or is it the very nature of reality? If it's a quality, then suppose Sat Chit Ananda were three different qualities of Brahman. Then you could take away one of the qualities and still it would have the other two qualities. Because qualities are something... Here, suppose I have the quality my skin is dark and then I go out of the sun for a while and the quality changed, my skin is fair. So, even though I'm the same, I have different qualities, and those qualities can change. I can give up some qualities, I can take on others. But fire is hot and luminous. Hot and luminous. Are those qualities of fire, or is it the very nature of fire? That if you take away the heat or luminosity, it's not fire. It's the very nature of the thing. These are not qualities of Brahman, three separate qualities, because Brahman has no qualities. It's nirguna. It's the very nature, what? That it's existence beyond time and space. That's its nature. That existence is pure consciousness. It can't lose that. That which is beyond time and space is pure consciousness. And it's called bliss only because there's no multiplicity in it. It's the bliss of no second thing. It's not bliss, like I told you, happiness. You know, in deep sleep, your experience, think about deep, your experience. How do you think about deep sleep? Deep sleep? Well, I wasn't aware of anything. You remove everything. In deep sleep, I didn't know myself, I didn't know the world, I didn't even know that there was no world. I knew nothing. That's the bliss of the self. The waking ego says, that's bliss, that's crap, that's boring. I don't want sleep. I'm having all the fun here. In deep sleep, I miss out on all the enjoyment. In deep sleep, it's just boring. But if you think about your experience of deep sleep, not how you think about it from the waking state where the ego says, I don't like deep sleep, I'd rather stay awake, I can have fun. In deep sleep, there's no boring, because boring is that you're there and nothing's happening. Time is passing and nothing's happening. But in deep sleep, there's no time, there's no ego, there's no boredom. There's just Satchit Ananda. Deep sleep is who you are. How you were in deep sleep, Satchit Ananda, is how you are right now. How you were in deep sleep is how you are right now. Your nature never changes. You didn't know anything in deep sleep, and you don't know anything now. You are Satchit Ananda. Ekam Advitiyam, one without a second. There's no second thing in deep sleep. How about in waking? Is there a second thing in waking?
Yeah,
because waking and dream are the same. There's no reality to them. There's no Dream is not something that exists. A dream is something that appears to exist, but in truth has no existence. It was only a dream. There was no dream tiger. There was no dream time, space. The whole thing was just an appearance. It was only a dream. The only reality was me, deep sleep. When the waking appeared, it's just an appearance in me. It has no reality. It just appears and disappears. It seems as though it exists, but in truth it never existed. What existed? Deep sleep. But when there's no waking or no dream, what is deep sleep? There's only sleep in relation to waking and dream. But when there's no waking or dream, what's the meaning of deep sleep? Deep sleep is the self. It's Atman. Every night we become one with Atman, but we don't know it. That self that we become one with, like the cup, where like the space in the jar. When the jar goes, we become one with the infinite space. When the jar comes back, we're in the waking. But the space is always the same. It never is limited by anything. It doesn't change. How I was in deep sleep is how I am right now, one without a second. I don't know anything, see anything, hear anything, feel anything. I am Satchitananda Swarupa. Shivoham, Shivoham. I am Shiva, that pure consciousness. That's the bliss. It's the very nature of the self. You can't lose it. It's not a quality. Satchitananda, not three qualities, but they're the very nature of that one self. In fact, to call it existence, consciousness, and bliss is really just a halfway house. In deep sleep, there's no existence, there's no consciousness, there's no bliss. We call it that from the waking point of view. But if you want to describe the self directly, there's only one way. Not this, not this. Neti, neti. There is no other way. You can call it self, Brahman, Atma. These words don't touch it. They're indirect descriptions. But if you want to know the self directly, not this, not this. When there's no waking, no dream, when no phenomena, nothing existent, nothing non-existent. In the 13th shloka of this chapter, which we're going to come to, he says, Tadgeyam aham pravakshami yat yatva amritam ashnute. I'm going to tell you that thing that has to be known, which having known, you will attain immortality. Anadimat param brahma nasat naasat uchite. It is that supreme Brahman which is not existence. Oh, it must be non-existence. And it's not non-existence. That's the neti neti. There's no, he says, I'm now going to tell you. And then he says, it's not existence and it's not non-existence. When you negate every single thing, that one thing that can't be negated is that self-shining consciousness. That's sleep. The absence of all duality is called sleep from the waking. But from your own point of view, it's your true self. And you never lose that nature. Even when the waking appears, you are sleep. And when it disappears, you are sleep. Sleep is Ananda. When there's no second thing, there's no fear, there's nobody who can hurt you. Fearlessness is not being in the world and not afraid of people or things. That's courage. But the fearlessness of non-duality is when there's no second thing. As long as there's a second thing, there'll be fear. It's only a non-duality that all fear ceases. As long as there's a second thing, something can limit you, something can harm you, something can affect you. But when there's no second thing, that's called abhayam, fearlessness, the fearless state of your own self, the self that fears nothing because there's nothing other than it to fear. That's ananda. That's the meaning of ananda. We shouldn't think of it as some experience of happiness. It's the absence of duality as ananda. It's not a quality of the self. It's the very nature of the self. You can't lose it. Any other question? 6 o'clock, you're free. Let's just do the Purnamada. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Good class. Thank you very much. So I guess we'll see. Oh, we got an evening class? Yeah.